From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're talking about native and web mobile design with Ren Lanier. I'm your host, Alea Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is brought to you by Crafts CMS, a content management system that doesn't suck. Whether you're a content strategist, developer, or content author, Craft has your back with some amazing features, like its powerful matrix field, which makes modular content degrees, or live preview, which shows you exactly how your entry will look on the front end while you're editing it. Craft is free for personal use and only $199 for most client sites. To learn more about it or to get your own personalized demo site, head over to buildwithcraft.com.
Mobile design is a hot topic these days, but it's also complex. There is no one right way to approach mobile design. Today, we're going to explore the differences and commonalities between native and web mobile design with Ren Lanier. Ren is a designer with a passion for creating beautiful digital projects. Since she started working on the web over 12 years ago, she's done a little bit of everything from advising startups on UX best practices to pushing pixels for Fortune 500 companies. She currently leads design and UX at HiRise, the content manager originally created by 37 Signals. Welcome to the show, Ren.
Thank you for having me.
So, Ren, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Well, I am sitting here in my home office in Durham, North Carolina. I get to work remotely, which is amazing. And I'm watching the rain fall and the leaves fall, and I'm thinking about all of the Halloween candy and the Halloween candy commercials that I keep hearing. I'm really susceptible to suggestion about things like Kit Kats and brownies, and I don't know. I heard a commercial for Kit Kats earlier today, and I kind of can't stop thinking about that flaky crispy crunch.
I can't even keep Halloween candy in the house until Halloween day because it will be gone.
Right.
Before we get into today's topic, Ren, how did you make the transition to mobile? When did you start experimenting with mobile design?
You know, a few years ago, it was probably 5 or 6 years ago, I was working for a digital agency that was doing a lot of mobile work early on, both mobile work for clients and developing some of our own products. So that gave me an opportunity to begin exploring the mobile space, I think, before a lot of other people were able to, because they sort of saw that as the future and jumped on the technology relatively early.
How did you get started learning? What was your process?
You know, I really immersed myself in it. And I remember in particular Josh Clark's book, Tapworthy. I remember spending just hours going through that. I remember even being at a park once reading it. I just have these strong memories of reading that book and taking in everything. I remember I also had an opportunity to see Sarah Parmenter speak at Front End Conference. And again, she was somebody just talking about the design conventions and the size of tap targets and things like that, that really helped me get started thinking about designing for touch.
So in regards to that, has the transition been different today? Like what they were talking about in regards to techniques on how to get started with mobile design?
I think Tapworthy in particular still holds up, even though the landscape has shifted a good deal. I believe Josh has another book that's just been sent to the printers, so I'm really excited to read that as well. Yes, I saw him tweeting about it the other day. So yeah, I think it's gotten more complex, and I think we've also started to revisit some of those early assumptions about just what is the quote unquote mobile context, and also I think some of the assumptions about how people hold their devices. Somewhere out there, I should have looked this up, there's a Tumblr of people holding and touching and tapping on their mobile devices in all sorts of different ways that you would never expect.
Right.
So I think there is something to be said for trying to design for the thumb area, you know, making things tappable. But at the same time, people hold their devices so many different ways that the thumb area is maybe not as primary as we once thought it was.
Yeah, it's funny because I remember on Twitter, I think it was Farouk actually, he just asked a question about, okay, do you text with one thumb or two thumbs, or do you use multiple fingers?
I'm curious, Ren, when you started Tapworthy, so this is really focused on the iPhone. That was really your scope of mobile at the time, like just dealing with the iPhone and thinking about those interactions and with regard to apps versus like a website on a phone or even other different phones? Was it really you started that narrowly?
You know, I think Tapworthy has a focus on iOS conventions in particular, but I think that a lot of the general principles it outlines can also be applied to responsive web, mobile websites just as easily.
So let's sort of talk about that nuance between native versus web. And tell me if I'm correct here, because this is not my area of expertise. Native refers to like an iOS app or an Android app, and that's mobile. And then mobile web would be like a website on a mobile device. Is that correct?
I would say that is correct. Yes, yeah, something you would be viewing through the mobile browser.
So how are the two different? How are they the same? I get that's a huge question, I know. So maybe if you could give like a couple fundamental examples that might be different in terms of assessing or even, you know, building for the two.
Well, so I thought about this a lot. And I think the best way to approach it is to rewind a little bit and to remember that mobile web pages are still constrained by the document object model, and they're constrained by the limitations of browser-based technology. And the web is amazing. The web is powerful, and it's also open, which I think is the best thing about the web, and I want the web to stay that way. But anyone who has ever tried reading through an opinion from a W3C committee understands how slowly the web moves in terms of adopting new standards and how, you know, the web is going through this democratic process of still supporting legacy choices and legacy paths from, you know, just practically decades ago. Whereas native platforms are walled gardens. Apple in particular, they make their own rules. And they don't have to worry about building consensus or supporting legacy choices. Apple just does what it wants and it sets the standards it wants. And that's the only way you get to play. So the native platforms can support more sophisticated design patterns than the mobile web. And it's because the native platforms don't have to be democratic and they don't have to be open and they don't care about supporting the past the way the web does. So on the web, I should be able to pull up a website from 1998 and it should work.
Right.
And it might look weird because it's in tables and it's 640 pixels wide and it's 10-point Verdano, which was never really a readable type size. But it should work because the web has that legacy support. If you try to run a native app that's even 2 or 3 years old, that hasn't been maintained and hasn't been updated or supported, God help you. So native gives you this ability to do a lot of cool stuff design-wise that the mobile web can't support as well. You know, so native can typically give you some better performance speed, some better response to touch, and a lot of things that are desirable. But there is this trade-off, and I'm not trying to slight the web for not having that.
It also feels like, I mean, I don't perceive that as a slight to the web. I heard it more as like, who would want to build apps? Like, you know what I mean? It's like you anything you build at some point, it becomes completely obsolete.
Very quickly.
That seems discouraging. Do you feel that? Is that accurate or is that just an assumption on my part?
You know, it certainly depends on the length of your cycle as a designer on a project. But, you know, if you're staying on the same app or the same product for a long time, you are constantly going to be updating it, constantly rebuilding it. At the same time, our web standards are constantly changing as well. I was complaining to someone the other day that you know, I have learned at least 5 different quote unquote correct ways to code a navigation menu in HTML and CSS. You know, and every few years there's a new, more standards compliant way of doing it. So in that sense, all of our technologies are constantly changing, but the native platforms and Apple's in particular does change particularly fast.
Yeah, I think that's probably, I don't know, it could be exciting.
Yes.
I like
it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, I think either way. Because, you know, I've read a lot of posts recently about, you know, people feeling that the web is getting knocked because, you know, it has some of the issues with dealing with performance compared to apps or, you know, even like Facebook apparently is going to, when you click on a link to an article, a resource or whatever, it's going to open it within an application as opposed to opening it in your browser and, you know, kind of the pros and cons of each. But I think either they both have their challenges. They both have their benefits. I think it depends on who you are as a designer and what you want to build.
And the other thing I will say is that in my experience as the designer, I typically have had very little influence on the decision of exactly what the technology stack looks like for any app that I work on. The platform choice is typically made by engineers, maybe with some input from the product owner. I mean, oftentimes, you know, the business, the stakeholders, they will want to be in the app store or whatever. But there are also so many technology constraints, staffing constraints, you know, can we get a developer? How much does that developer cost? Who's available? And again, just this perception of the marketplace. Do we want to launch on iOS first? Do we want to launch on Android first?
Right.
So really, the decision has very little to do with what you as a designer think would be super cool. You typically just have to work with the constraints that you're given.
Before we go on, Ren, you mentioned something there I was hoping you could define a little bit more, but you mentioned products. Can you explain what you're talking about with products? Because I think, is that an application? An app is a product? A website is a product?
You know, this is an interesting shift that I think is beginning to happen. And of course, there's no consensus here yet. But, you know, I have started calling myself a product designer. And there is this this beginning of this shift into sort of defining ourselves as product designers versus web designers. And when I think of products, I think of an application. Kenneth Bowles had a great series of tweets from about a year ago where he started to try and break down this difference. And he tweeted something like, behavior is the design material of products versus maybe something like content. And I think e-commerce is sort of an interesting overlap between the two, because on e-commerce, you could just browse and browse and browse and, you know, sort of consume pictures and consume descriptions. But then eventually, if you're going to add something to the cart and check out, now you're doing something that's more like a product. So if I think of the website for my local restaurant, you know, I just want to see the menu. I just want to see their hours. I want to see their location. But if we get to something like Chipotle allowing me to order my burrito ahead of time. That's becoming something more of like a product.
Interesting.
So I'm really curious about, you know, with kind of the overlapping aspect of designing for products versus mobile apps versus native versus web, because I feel like there is a lot of overlap, especially since you work for HiRise. You can access HiRise on your browser. I'm sure there, at least for Basecamp, there is a mobile website to actually interact with your Basecamp items. But Basecamp also has its own mobile app. And, you know, I'm assuming that designers have to cater for different reasons, for different things, even though the task in and of itself, you know, say as a Basecamp user, I'm going to go take a look at my to-do list or messages and interact with that, is the same. Like the purpose is the same, but the interaction and design between the mobile browser website versus the mobile app.
Yes.
I want to talk about the design process and thinking and the difference between how you would approach the mobile website. And they're both products. But I would assume that the approach is different for the browser versus the native app.
It is. We have designed a somewhat limited mobile website version of HiRISE. You can also access the full HiRISE from your browser, but it is not currently mobile optimized. But you are somewhat, let me go back. I think one of the biggest challenges when designing for any small screen is dealing with the issue of your limited amount of real estate. And I think that's one of the biggest differences between mobile design and what I think of as web design the way I practiced it 5 or 6 years ago. There was a time when we would often be trying to sort of fill up empty space. Like, we need something to put in this third column so that the page balances, or something to put in the footer to add some visual interest. And so suddenly we're like, is there a logo? Is there an image? Are there some social links? Like, we're just like looking around for content, basically. And that never happens in mobile. Like, in mobile, you're actually, it's the opposite. You're trying to remove things. You're trying to figure out, what can we hide? What can we put in a menu somewhere that's not always visible? What does need to be always visible? So when it comes to those sort of clever hiding solutions and, you know, menus and flyouts and popovers, it becomes a little bit, it's easier and more elegant to do that with native code. And you can do some of that, you know, on the mobile web and in a responsive way. It's absolutely possible, and HTML5 makes a lot of that possible. But it's just, you don't have quite as many options for hiding and revealing things on the mobile web.
Interesting. So when it comes to dealing with that small space, is there like a checklist, a rule of thumb that you follow when you're deciding what to limit, what to show and hide? Does it kind of almost correlate when you're dealing with content strategy for a traditional website, determining what the priorities are, determining what the actions you want to happen are?
Very much so. I would say that good mobile design begins with content first design. You know, so you have that limited real estate and, you know, oftentimes possibly a limited attention span as well. So you need to be clear about what is and isn't critical to the experience at hand and design for that. I think good mobile design is like any other good UX design, that it should provide exactly what the user needs when they need it without the clutter or the extraneous distractions. So yeah, I think there has to be more focus on the content than ever before.
Have you encountered a situation where that has been difficult to convey to the decision makers? Like, for example, having that kind of discussion with just a traditional website with a client can be a challenge because everyone thinks their content's the most important content. You know, the different departments thinks theirs is most important. And just to get them to get to consensus when you have quite a bit of real estate compared to a smaller screen, how do you have those conversations with people who maybe don't understand the need for focus?
I think it is hugely challenging. And oftentimes when dealing with stakeholders, you know, very senior stakeholders, it becomes a series of compromises. Mm. I think there was a period of time, across mobile, the hamburger menu is right. Sort of wonderful in that unlike the tabs at the bottom where you can sort of have four tabs and then a more, and nobody wants their sort of line of business to be shoved behind more. with the hamburger menu, you could sort of give so many more aspects equal visibility. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I wish I had a magic bullet for dealing with those sort of stakeholder disputes. I think user testing, even getting early designs into the hands of users and showing users something that has too many menu items, too many things on the page, too many boxes and arrows, can be a way to begin to let people know that some things are just going to have to be less visible.
Yeah, that was occurring to me when you were talking about it, that would be a really good case for something like, we had Travis Gertz on the show talking about live wires, which are web-based wireframes, mm-hmm. and that's a really good opportunity instead of a comp where we're sending it to a client and they just see this, you know, tall, skinny image that they can look in their browser and mm-hmm. scroll through on their browser because they're hardly ever looking at that on their phone. You give them something that's interactive and all of a sudden then they're, because right now I literally 3 days ago had a conversation about it needs to be above the fold. And I was like, well, pick up your phone and hold it this way and then hold it this way. Where's the fold? Tell me where the fold yes. is, you know?
Yeah.
And so getting it in their hands even sooner. Is that how your workflows are that you deal? Are you designing in the app or in the browser sooner?
I absolutely, when designing for mobile, want to do prototypes that can mm-hmm. be viewed on a mobile device. Typically, for the last year or so, I've been using InVision. And mm-hmm. InVision has a great way that you can enter in mobile numbers and it will just send a message to the person, like a text message, and they can just tap on the link and open the prototype like right there on their phone. And whatever sort of HTML5, you know, technology that InVision is using, it's nice because the fold is such a myth on mobile because everybody's devices are different sizes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, even iPhones, there's such a variety among iPhone sizes now. So InVision does a good job of sort of appropriately scaling your mock-ups so that potentially two stakeholders with two different sized phones could sit there and look at it and sort of see how it would look different mm. on their actual devices.
Interesting. So I kind of want to take a step back and talk about a couple of things that you mentioned earlier. So you mentioned, you know, a fundamentally good mobile design is content first design. I'm curious to know what you believe are other really good principles of good mobile design. What should designer always make sure when they're designing for mobile?
Yeah, content first design and clearly prioritized design. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges as a designer, because like you said, when working with stakeholders, they often have difficulties amongst themselves setting their priorities.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so constantly pushing for that and pushing clients to make what I would call the difficult choices. I think that good mobile design has involved a lot of difficult choices in order to make those priorities really clear. And mm-hmm. if you, I remember seeing something in a movie once about writing, like writing a novel is about making choices. And if you don't make choices, you just end up with a novel that sort of has everything in the kitchen sink in it and it goes all over the place. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens to a mobile app. You know, you see a mobile app that nobody was willing to make choices. Nobody was willing to make compromises. Everybody sort of got their way and it ends up just kind of being a mess. And as a designer, there's only so much you can do mm-hmm. to fix that. That good mobile design requires hard choices and it requires good engineering. Mm-hmm. I think all good UX requires good engineering. And again, if there's an unwillingness to invest in the back-end technology to make the app work properly, there's no clever UI that's just going to like magic it all away and make it that seamless Apple experience that everybody wants. You know, I can't make a four-step process into a one-step process with the magic of UI design if you're mm-hmm. not willing to invest in the engineering for it to be a one-step process.
Right.
So does that affect your role, either where you are now or where you have worked in the past? Have you had the opportunity to work with the engineers or the content strategists, you know, to either influence or inform or at least be aware of what was happening? Or do you kind of work in a siloed fashion as the designer?
I think working in mobile, I always work very closely with developers mm-hmm. and with whomever is developing. We shipped a high-rise iOS app earlier this year, and our CTO and I were in a constant tight feedback loop as I was providing new designs and he was building things into the app and we were looking at them in alpha. So definitely you have to be able to work closely with developers. I have not had the opportunity to work with content strategists on an app. I would love to have that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And some of my best friends are content strategists. I think they are doing the good work. But I think if that were possible, the content strategist could make a designer's life so much easier. And mm-hmm. I often feel that some of the hardest parts about mobile projects are just me acting as an ad hoc content strategist.
You're having to make the decisions when it gets in front of you and you have to find a way to deal with everything they gave you.
Yes, yes.
So do you think that mobile requires a different skill set than traditional design?
You know, that's a good question. When I think back about it, I remember a time when in web design, you could almost get away with being something more like a traditional graphic designer, you know, sort of laying out web pages more like posters.
Right.
or a magazine spread. And as designers, we didn't really care what the content was. And in fact, we often didn't know what it was. We would get the content from the client like at the very last minute.
Right.
And sort of
lorem ipsum it.
Right. You would just flow it in to replace all the lorem ipsum. And you really can't do that with any kind of mobile design, including responsive design. You have to be focused on content and priority. There was a great article in A List Apart last week about object-oriented UX that I think makes this point incredibly well about modeling the relationships between different content blocks for a big responsive site.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition, you know, to the traditional focus on typography or colors, I think for mobile design, there has to be a focus on the UX and the user needs.
And I'd say just based on what you've described, it seems to, and also seeing Leia working with our clients, and this could be the same as it's always been, but I feel like there's just a lot more communication and education involved when Leia hands over a mobile comp to a client. There's a lot more discussion of what's going on, why the choices were being made. And so I feel like communicating and understanding user experience is even more important to, you know, mobile design than we've ever seen it before.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. I think it's also true, and I don't know if this is mitigated in the last few years, but I think that in my experience, clients often had what seemed like unrealistic expectations for maybe the business performance of their mobile apps.
Right.
And it's the sense of the gold rush. And I'm sure this was sort of true for the web, you know, maybe in 1998 or 1999. But there's this sense everybody thinks they're going to be the next Twitter or Facebook if they just launch, right? if they just get into the app store.
Right.
And so I think that sort of setting realistic expectations just around the marketing of apps and just how competitive the ecosystem can be is also important.
Yeah, it's interesting because you mentioned that, how they just think, okay, if I have an app, I'm going to be rich. but that brings the question over like, well, what if whatever they need is fine in the browser versus like just investing in an entire app? How do you think they should make that decision, the native versus web decision?
Well, and there's also, you know, I would say if we're talking about native,
right,
or an app, let's just say that's something that they install on their phone versus bookmarking a website with their mobile browser. So there are certainly different paths to getting an installed app on someone's phone. But if you're going to do that, then something in that app should be taking advantage of the native features of the device.
Right.
So, you know, whether that's the GPS or whether that's the camera, so many content sites, and I'm thinking of news sites like Mashable, they want to be installed on your phone so that they can send you push notifications and just kind of spam you with all of their breaking articles.
Right.
So, yeah, if there is not truly a need to be taking advantage of the device hardware, you know, if you are the local restaurant and people just want to see your menu and your hours, then yeah, I always encourage those clients to have a really good responsive web page and just, you know, make their mobile browser experience as good as possible. But again, so many people they want what they feel is the marketing advantage of being in the app store and being installed on the device.
You say what they think is a marketing advantage. Is there any kind of analytics or statistics that get back to app developers that could, let's say, you know, the client who doesn't actually need the app but insists on the app, and then they want to know why it's not working. Does Apple give information back out to app developers about who's using it and what and how, or is that just a vacuum?
You know, my understanding when we, and because again, these things change so frequently, but when we did the HiRISE app earlier this year, we sort of had to build in our own analytics in a really meaningful way. I mean, I guess we can get, you know, something like the number of downloads from the Apple App Store.
Yeah, it's probably like what they give us for the podcast, like nothing. Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
Just some general sense that some people are listening.
Yeah.
On iTunes, we have that bar. It doesn't even give you numbers. It just gives you a bar to show you if that episode was listened to a lot or not.
Yeah, so we use the same analytics platform in our mobile app as we use in our regular web application. We use Heap Analytics. Mm. So, you know, in terms of measurability, I would not say that we can somehow necessarily measure all these amazing metrics in our native app that we can't measure on the web. That I would not say that's true.
Speaking of analytics, I know that a lot of web apps and websites really rely on analytics and data to drive some design choices. How much does data affect native mobile app design?
That's a good question. I think a lot of it depends on whether you're building a new product or whether you're building an app for an existing product. So, for example, when we built the HiRISE iOS application, obviously, we already have tons of data about our users and what features they use the most.
Right.
And, you know, we could make some assumptions, and then we could go into beta and get feedback. Whereas if you're developing a brand new application, you know, especially if it's something that you're trying to open up a new market, you know, an application people don't even know that they want yet, then there's not going to be a lot of data available to you about user behaviors. But if you start with a sort of lean UX process, hopefully you can kind of get some validation along the way to understand what's going to be the most important features and parts of your app.
I'm curious if there's a, you know, you were describing when a native app really makes sense, which aside from marketing needs, it comes down to, do you really need to use the native device features?
Mm-hmm.
But is there like a hybrid model where there's something that embraces both native and web?
You know, a lot of applications that even appear to be native are using some, if not all, of what we would call web views inside of them. I think even, you know, Instagram is using a lot of web views. Evernote uses web views. Twitter uses web views. So even though there's an aspect of native development there, they're also bringing things in. And it's nice. It's nice when you can use web views because the content on that page, you can update it from your own servers rather than having to resubmit to the App Store and go through the approval process.
Right.
And all of that. And then sort of, you know, having to get new ratings on your new version and all of that stuff. So when you can build pieces of your app in web views, that's often a wonderful benefit. But again, that's usually a choice that's going to be made by the developers, by the engineers, you know, based on what can our API handle and what's going to give us the best performance benefit.
So how does that affect you as the designer? If some stuff has to be run through the native app and then some stuff is being pulled by the web, does that affect anything really in your design process?
I have not encountered a lot of impacts to that. I don't even think there would be impacts if you wanted to sort of slide some things around. I'm thinking of Google's Inbox app, where you have that nice sort of, you can swipe left or swipe right to, you know, check something off or save it for later. And I bet there's a big web component even in that UI. So probably not. But again, that's something I would work through very closely with my development team.
So I'm a little bit curious about that swipe left, swipe right, and that it seems like a very native mobile interaction. What I'm curious about as a designer is that we're seeing a lot of mobile native design choices bleeding into websites. I guess this is actually like a multi-part question. First of all, do you think that is a good direction for desktop or even just generic web mobile experience to mimic like native app design? And why? Like why are we heading that way?
You know, I'm starting to see a lot of desktop websites that have the hamburger menu with the hidden navigation. And I really don't understand why. I mean, I think maybe it's this grasp towards sort of minimalism. And again, the popularity of like the huge hero images. And it's like, oh, we can just sort of have the huge hero image and not spoil it with a menu. But as a user experience designer, I feel like you're just making it harder for people to find your content.
Right.
So yeah, I think a lot of desktop sites can take that too far in terms of borrowing sort of patterns from mobile design. But if I were to really sort of stand up on a soapbox, I would say that I don't think the web needs to be using native design patterns, but I do think that the mobile web needs to stop damaging itself in an attempt to promote native apps. Mm. So, man, those banners that pop up, download our app, you know, you hit a new site and then sort of, you know, 18% of your screen is taken up with this banner to download the app. And then there are popover ads over, you know, everything below that.
Right.
On my iPad the other night, I was looking at some Yelp reviews, and Yelp would only allow me to view a portion of reviews on the mobile web. They were forcing me to download the app in order to view the entire, man, it's not the it is not the hamburger menu that is ruining the mobile web. It is that crap. That is hostile. So that is what's hurting the mobile web, not a lack of better UI design. It's this trying to force people into the walled gardens instead of allowing them to take advantage of the open nature of the web.
Or have them have the choice. I mean, I can think of a dozen different sites that I use on my desktop that I have apps for, that I might use the app on my phone, but I use the desktop on my desktop, or use the web on my desktop rather. And, you know, I think as a user, that's the kind of stuff I couldn't agree with you more. Like if I click on a link to a website and they're like, would you like to view this on our app?
No.
I clicked the link for a reason. It's like we talk about user experience all the time. That's just fundamental taking away a user's experience. Right. It makes no sense.
Yeah. And that I've already, you know, I'm usually in the middle of searching for something and, you know, many Google searches, and I'm trying to put the right keyword string in to find what I'm looking for. And like, I'm going to have to download your app, and then I'm just going to have to search again inside your app. It's such a time waster.
Yeah, it's almost like somehow bells and whistles are trumping, you know, the fundamental delivery of information to people.
Yes.
You know, I don't quite understand that. And it's probably why I, you know, personally don't have a huge amount of interest in apps, because I just, my nature goes towards that sort of more open nature of the web.
Absolutely.
Well, what I'm curious about too is, like, for example, it's just top of mind because I visited it recently, but Squarespace's site, it's not a mobile app. It literally is, the service is to give other people websites, but their entire design is borrowing a lot from the mobile app. As you mentioned, that hamburger thing, that's exactly Squarespace's navigation. They've got their main navigation that's discoverable, says overview, commerce, cover pages, build it beautiful, whatever that means. And then you have to click on the hamburger icon to see home, tour, customers, template, you know, like, and get, and even the word gets
important.
Started. Exactly. So I just find that like really curious in terms of like who's pushing for this. I understand that trends occur and, you know, clients sometimes say, I saw this thing and I want it. But it's curious to me that a web service whose primary customer is websites is pushing for more mobile patterns.
It's just not that difficult to build a responsive site that has a fully visible menu on larger screens
right.
that then minimizes down to a hamburger menu on
right.
smaller screens. Like it's, I can't even say, oh, but it's just so hard and they don't want to put the work in. It's not that hard.
Mm-hmm. I think it's got to be just the new pretty, you know, oh, I want to try this thing. I saw it's cool. And
do you know what I feel like it is? It's almost like that old school, like 1990s to 2000 thinking of like everything needs to look the same everywhere,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is ironically an old fashioned way of thinking,
mm-hmm.
you know, because if we design mobile first and then all the way to the desktop, it still looks like the mobile site, you know, and it's like taking it to that next level where it's just like, well, fine, I guess it looks nice, but is that really functionally the right approach? I don't know.
Well, and I think one of the most interesting things I've seen recently, and I can't remember if this was Kenneth Bowles or someone else who talked about this in a presentation, was about, you know, when we talk about designing for different sized screens, what we usually mean is designing for small screens and how do we take this desktop design and then, you know, origami fold mm-hmm. it down into something for like a phone.
Right.
But there's really not much, they're not designers talking and taking advantage of the people with 2400 pixel wide screens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a ton
right.
of real estate.
Right.
And you could be doing really cool things for those people as well, instead of presenting them with a hamburger menu, which is optimized mm-hmm. for a tiny little touch device.
right. It's a different experience at the end of the day, right?
Yeah.
This is kind of like a discussion about where, how the web evolves and how, you know, we never figure it out right away. It takes years of being like, oh, mobile's not just small screens. Like there's people saying that,
yeah,
but not everyone's executing it that way,
exactly.
you know, and that design, it's not just, like you said, going from desktop top to small, there's everything in between and lots of, you know, there's just, we're, I think we're always looking for like a single solution and we mm-hmm. get fixated on something when it starts working and we stop looking for a period mm-hmm. of time at what else is out there that we should be looking at. I think that's just how we evolve.
Yeah. And there was this excellent article by Luke Rybluski
mm-hmm.
about obvious always wins.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of that hamburger icon, it's super controversial, not just because what the hell is a hamburger icon to a normal human being, but the fact that people just got so enamored with it that they started making all menus as a hamburger icon, don't even have the word menu on it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then his statistics showed that just having the actual words in a rounded corner box was mm-hmm. more interactive than the hamburger
mm-hmm.
menu because it was obvious.
You know what was ironic? I remember when, you know, even in native apps, the sort of slide over hamburger menu really became the popular design paradigm.
Totally.
Like over tabs at the bottom.
Sure.
And it was really because of Facebook. When
right.
Facebook brought it in, and I remember, I know this, I was in one of these meetings, I might have been one of the people saying this, we would have these discussions about the usability of the hamburger menu, because again, it gave us so many good options with many stakeholders, with many demands. We're like, whew, this is going to make our lives so easy. But people would say, you know, are users going to open it? Are they going to know what to do? Are they going to be able to find these things?
Right.
And what we would say, what we said was, well, if Facebook is doing it, I'm sure it works.
Right.
They must have tested it, right?
Like they must have tested it.
They must have tested it. And it turns out that they really didn't have a good testing process in place at that time. And they hadn't really tested it. And eventually, after looking at their analytics and seeing the effects of it, they went back to tabs. And then all of us who were just sort of stupidly assuming that Facebook knew what they were doing, like they really didn't.
Well, not until you put it out there and test it, right? Like you can
right.
only design and then test your assumptions. And if it doesn't work, then you need to fix it. I find that's also the same even in terms of just stylistically mobile design. For example, mm-hmm. flat design is quote-unquote flat slash Swiss design traditionally is everywhere now. Everyone doesn't want to have any sort of gradients or shadows anymore. And I know that, you know, styles change the same way fashion changes over the years. But what I find fascinating, speaking of Facebook, is that I've been noticing a lot of new interface tweaks in general where they're moving slightly away from flat design now.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed that their checkboxes have gradients in them. So it looks raised, and like their boxes now have more pronounced bottom borders. So it looks a lot more like shadows, and their headlines have different background. What's it called? Instead of just using like a single like 3CCC line, it's now like the entire background is different now, so it's more differentiated, and so are their icons are having a lot more drop shadows. And I feel like that's a response to the fact that 100% flat is not necessarily the right solution when you're trying to emphasize something on the page and to indicate that it's clickable. Because if and that, me as a designer, freaking pisses me off, you know, because when everyone started going towards, you know, flat design, there's some things that I really, really like about it. But other things for me, like in terms of like interactivity to like, okay, is this clickable? Well, if it all looks the same.
Yes. And the more recent versions of iOS, you know, since iOS 7 have definitely brought that flat aesthetic and just sort of lack of button styles. Now everything's text. It can be very, very confusing at times.
So let's talk a little bit more about some of these patterns that we're talking about, we're sort of bitching about right now. But do you think there are any native mobile patterns that you would like to see more in the web or vice versa? You like specifics?
You know, mostly I would really just like to see the mobile web embrace, be the best mobile web it can possibly be, instead of being a vector to tell you to download the native app. Because on the occasions that I see a really well-designed, responsive website on my, I mean, it's great. It's fine. It's awesome. I don't even think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that still feels like such a small percentage of the mobile web that's out there, that so many sites are either, they're either not optimized for touch screens or smaller screens, or if they are optimized, I'll use some air quotes there, then it's really more about forcing you to download the app.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So just for the mobile web to be the best mobile web it could be, would be a nice step forward.
Can you give me some examples of what some of those optimizations would be for a good mobile slash touch experience?
You know, I think for the touch experience, it's really about large, obvious touch targets.
Mm-hmm.
It still frustrates me on some of my favorite e-commerce sites that when I go there on my iPad, there's just this long text menu down the left side of all the different departments. And, you know, if I want to click on denim or dresses, I always end up tapping the wrong thing. Like there's not enough space between, you know, and I'm literally zooming in to try and successfully tap on sweaters.
Right.
And 2015, almost 2016 for big global brands, like that shouldn't be happening. I should have an easy way without zooming in to just tap on the menu selection that I want to make.
Yeah. And that's you as a person who knows how to zoom.
Yeah.
Most people have no clue.
No.
Yeah, I find that extremely frustrating about Amazon. And I even was like, all right, screw this. I'm going to get the app and try and do it from there. And their app sucks.
Yeah.
Makes no sense. You can't use their website on a mobile device because the tap targets, that's my biggest beef with it, especially when and you have to like tap twice to get the menu to expand. And then I just want to look at my orders. And then I click that and it ends up taking me somewhere else. And it's so frustrating. And their app isn't much better.
Yeah. And again, this is one of those things that Josh Clark wrote about in Tapworthy, about the importance of big touchable tap targets. Mm-hmm. And so you would think by 2015 that we could like move on to something better than that. But there's still so many sites, big, well-funded sites that are getting this wrong.
Because I think it's that above the fold thinking again. Do you know what I'm saying? Because it's just like, let's shove as much as we can into this small, small space because we need to be fit every single like widget in that small area. And, you know, that ends up squishing a lot of tap targets into areas that doesn't make much sense.
Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to when you're designing, Ren, do you create your own assets from scratch or do you use like templates for icons or skins or anything?
I always create all of my own assets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in terms of a lot of those UI kits that are available, I mean, I guess for someone, if you're still sort of learning your tools and back when skeuomorphism was more the rage of the day, those things were sometimes nice just to sort of learn, how do I create gradients like this?
Mm,
you know,
right.
how do I layer, you know, it's a good learning opportunity to get to know your tools better. But in terms of actually designing, I always design my own assets. I do almost all of my design in Sketch now.
Interesting. Mm.
And what was amazing when we launched the HiRISE app this year, we're serving all of our assets directly out of a vector sketch file.
Oh, interesting.
So that was a huge new innovation for me as a mobile designer because, you know, when I started out, I was generating the at 2x image or like the at 3, you know, just generating, breaking out different assets, you know, for the different resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
So to be able to take a vector file and just serve the icon as needed out of the vector file was pretty sweet.
But that is that specific to native app stuff? Because I don't think we can necessarily do that for web. And I mean, I guess SVGs.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that was a native. So that was just, that was built in to the app that way.
So do you have a gallery of mobile patterns that you refer to during your design process?
You know, there are several galleries that I will go to, you know, often if I'm stuck on a particular sort of, you know, like a list view or, you know, opening and closing an area or, you know, just wanting to see some of the fresher ideas that are out there. One that I really like is captivate.co.
Okay.
That's Ali Dreyer's site. And she also has an iOS app for Captivate now as well. But she focuses a lot on transitions and animations as like within the UI. So, you know, all of her examples move around, and that's really cool. I like mobile-patterns.com, and then there's another site called, it's patterns.pttrns.com. So there are plenty of good pattern libraries out there if you just sort of need something to help jog some inspiration.
Are there actual apps that you always open that you think is like, okay, this is a great designed app. Let me like play around with this to just give me ideas.
It's a good question. You know, I don't know if I would universally say it's a great designed app, but I often look at the native Twitter app.
Yeah. Mm.
They have a variety of different views and you know, they've got a good team that works on that product. They're constantly pushing updates. So I always like to see, how did Twitter do this in their app?
And to sort of jump forward after the design process, after you've gone through your inspiration, where do you fit testing in?
You know, it definitely depends on the kind of testing. So if I'm working on what I would think of as a new product, like a startup, then hopefully we've been doing some sort of lean UX validation testing early on and, you know, trying to get something into the hands of people to get a sense of how they would use it, how they respond to it. But then usability testing typically happens, you know, much later in the process. And again, sometimes I do a sort of planned testing, like a more formalized testing. For HiRISE, we had a beta program. So we had several hundred users. We were able to distribute a beta builds of the app to them using Test Flight, which was acquired by Apple a few years ago. And so again, we could just collect feedback very organically that way. And I think for us, for HiRISE, our UI changes are really only meaningful for people when they can see them in the context of their own data, like their own context, you know, their own contacts, their own notes, their own emails. So even if it was like very well crafted fake data, I think it would still be hard for people to really understand what this was going to look like if they're not seeing their own stuff. So to be able to do live testing with a beta and test flight, I think is hugely valuable.
And is that another thing where you're working closely with the back end on resolving those things as each thing comes through that you guys want to attack? Or does it start with you and then trickle?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some, you know, a lot of engineering support for setting up beta users. And I forget what that whole process looks like, but that's not something that I could have executed alone just as the designer. You know, you usually need support from engineering to get actual alpha or beta builds of your app into users' hands.
And then they would work with you as you would resolve issues and such?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, we on our own team would be using it, and then we would be getting feedback from our users, and that would just sort of go into the bug queue or the development queue to resolve.
And then once the app is out there, you're not in alpha, or what is alpha? Is alpha like just a small internal?
Yeah, alpha is what we would do for just our internal team.
And so once the app is out there, how do you approach when people report issues? Do they just go into a queue, or, you know, how do you decide when a new update is coming out?
That's a good question. For us, knock on wood, we've not had a huge number of technical issues with our app, nor a huge number of usability issues. I was really, really impressed and sort of surprised. So what we get are feature requests, because our iOS app is not feature complete on par with the desktop web application. So in that sense, you know, it's leaning more towards product management and in terms of what additional features or additional enhancements do we want to build.
Right. And you actually brought up a point as to like why I personally would prefer sometimes using their web mobile website versus their app because of the feature completeness. It's just sometimes the app still needs some time to catch up and, okay, I want to go to their website because it has all the stuff that I need.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that that's something we're hoping to change. And I think as more and more products launch mobile first, that is changing. I mean, if you look at something like Instagram, there's so much I can do with Instagram on my phone that I can't do like from the desktop website.
Right.
So it definitely depends on where the product started out.
I think for me as a user, that I find that to be my greatest frustration. Basically, like let's take my Roku, for example. If I use the Netflix app on a Roku, it's different than the Netflix app on the Xbox, which is different than the Netflix website. And I find it so frustrating because there'll be like a really great feature on one of them and it's not available in any others.
Yeah.
And I know that's a total different departure, but I feel like again, somehow the user's getting lost in all this experimentation.
Well, part of it is like the politics of the devices you're using, right? Because there's certain things that you might be allowed to do or not allowed to do for Android that you can do in iPhone, or there's a convention that Android users are used to in terms of user experience that iPhone users aren't used to, and vice versa. And then there's also like legalities and their own walled ideas of what their interface guidelines are going to be. And I feel like some devices are like, yep, just do whatever. And other ones are like, this must conform to Xbox tile app styling, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you've just described the conundrum and the difficulties of that walled garden mindset, you know, that the same product will be slightly different or somewhat different inside each walled garden.
Right.
Again, the user. It's not the user who anyone's paying attention to. Before we wrap up, I wanted to get your thoughts about what you think the biggest misconception about designing for the native mobile experience versus the web mobile experience.
You know, I think the biggest misperception, I think particularly still among stakeholders, is this idea that everyone who's on their phone is on the go or, you know, walking down the sidewalk or killing 90 seconds in line at the grocery store. There are lots of people today who use their phone as the primary way of accessing the internet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even for those of us with many devices and an ease of internet access, we still do stuff on our phone from the couch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally. Me too.
I do stuff on my phone while I am sitting in front of my computer.
Yes.
Right? You know, like I get a Facebook message or something from somebody and I just pick up my phone and start replying.
So true.
I do think that mobile experiences should be very clear and direct, but we really shouldn't think that they need to be limited or, you know, exclusively designed for short attention spans, mm-hmm. that people are doing everything on their phones. This was a few years ago now that I read this, that eBay's car auctions, eBay Motors, were selling like Ferraris and Lamborghinis off of the eBay auctions on mobile. Like there are people buying Ferraris from their mobile phone. There is nothing that people are not doing mm-hmm. from mobile.
Wow. There's just so much to really, you know, dive into with the mobile web experience. But I want to leave our listeners with some advice. So what's the best advice you have for those approaching mobile web design in general?
I think it's to have an unwillingness to unlearn and throw away a lot of the design patterns that you've learned for the desktop web. Just like I've had to throw away all those different ways of coding a navigation menu in HTML and CSS, you just have to be willing to let go of some of those, some of your darlings even. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are things like hover. Like hover just doesn't really make sense in a touchscreen context. So Luke Robolewski has talked about this, how we as designers are still unlearning these patterns that are ingrained in us from the desktop web, from the, mm-hmm. the mouse-based web.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's to really be open-minded and to really be able to think of this as like a whole sort of new set of design principles.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Very cool. But before we finish up, we have our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better.
Ooh.
Are you ready, Ren?
I don't know if I'll ever be ready, but here we go.
Okay. First question, Android or iOS?
I personally use iOS.
If you are stranded on a desert island and you can only bring three things, what would you bring?
Oh my gosh, my favorite pillow and some snacks and a really good book.
All the comforts.
Yes.
What's your favorite TV show?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I don't know about of all time, but lately I've just been watching everything British that's on Netflix.
Nice.
You know, so I go in for Sherlock Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, one of my favorite. And that stuff.
What's your favorite dessert?
Anything with a lot of chocolate in it.
What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
You know, I've always said that if I ever leave tech, that I would want to become an urban planner and an urban designer. I think to me, that feels like user experience on the grandest scale possible,
mm-hmm, sure,
of, you know, sidewalks and bike lanes and parks and really designing the experience of the communities that people live in, I think would be fascinating.
What profession would you not like to try?
I don't want to do anything like accounting. Anything that involves attention to detail.
What's the latest article or blog post you read?
About tech or just in general?
In general.
I read something about the woman whose Jeopardy response went viral. I think I'm always fascinated by what content goes viral and people who experience their 15 minutes of internet fame,
Right.
Which I think is terrifying. And I never want to have my 15 minutes of internet fame.
I was just going to say, I never want that to happen to me.
No, I never want that to happen to me either.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
To fly.
What music do you like to work to?
I listen to a lot of the chill stations on RDO. Indie chill wave, coffee house chill, just very
relaxing.
It is. It's, I, you know, I've basically become the 2000 teens version of an easy listener, the easy, easy listening person. I realize this now. It's terrifying. But
all right. Last question. Cats or dogs?
Cats. Yay. I have two.
So do I. We're cat people here. So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
You can find me at renlinear.com, and you can find my occasional musings on Twitter at HeyRen.
Thanks again. It was so nice talking with you today.
Thank you so much.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Thank you, Pixel and Tonic.
We'd also like to thank our partners, Arcus Tech, DevOT, and EE Insider.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we'll talk about Cartthrob for Expression Engine e-commerce with Matt Weinberg. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, controlclickcast.com/schedule, for more upcoming topics.
This is Leia Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.